Well, good morning, everyone. How's everyone doing this morning?
Good.
I hope well. Well, for the last 17 weeks, if you can believe it, we've been working through the life and lyrics of King David. We've walked with this man as a young shepherd boy. We've seen him have great victories over giants like Goliath. We've journeyed with him as he's worked to elude capture, as running from cave to cave with King Saul hot on his trail. And now we're at the story where he's become king of this nation on the rise. Along the way, we've read of these beautiful lyrics, these beautiful songs that David has written to his protector, to his sustainer, to his savior, the Lord Almighty. But as Troy alluded to last week, with great power comes great responsibility. That's my Spider-Man quote right there for you guys. Over the next few weeks, we're going to interact with King David in a very different place, in a much different space, in a completely different frame of reference than what we've known of the king up to this point. You see, the Confessions of 2 Samuel is a story of triumph, but it's also a story of tragedy. It's a confession of truth where the narrator holds no punches in retelling both the fortunes of our king as well as the foibles of this man after God's own heart. And it's within this context of confession in 2 Samuel that I have to come and confess something to you guys. My job, what I do week in and week out, is to read and critique what I read. As an editor, I weekly work through and often bleed over hundreds of pages of other people's writings. And this would all be fine and dandy if it wasn't for a little secret I have as an editor. I'm going to tell you guys this morning. It's the secret that I could really care less for plot. Yes, that little piece of the story that generally covers about 80% of the pages we read, I really just don't care for it. It's probably not a good confession to make as an editor. That little nuance of the story, you know, that thing called plot that describes characters acting, characters actually doing things, characters acting, being acted upon, making decisions, all of that I really would just like to skip over when I read. Plot and I have had this long history of animosity, a war of words, if you will, and chief among the fatalities in this war have been my ego. One of my writing professors in college critiqued one of my stories. I got back this short story from him with his critique to say, "Jeremiah, if you are anything like the characters you write about, you really don't have a lot going on in your life." Because these characters are incredibly boring. They don't do anything. And I learned then in that college class, and I'm reminded of every single day I start up my computer to start editing other people's work, of the age-old adage of, those who can't write, well, we become editors. That's what ends up happening to us. And I wouldn't say I haven't tried to write plot. It's not that. My literary sins happen to run a lot deeper than that. It's simply that I am not a patient reader when it comes to literature. I'm the kind of guy that reads the first chapter and skips to the last page. And if the resolution's decent and the characters are decent, yeah, I may read a little bit in between. It makes for incredibly quick reads of books, but admittedly, I miss most of the action. I miss most of the good stuff, most of the plot, the things that make life interesting. So with that said, today, this morning, I'm going to start where all of you purists, all you people who read books normally, are going to cringe at. I want to start the story at the end. Now, before there's mutiny in the ranks, before half you guys stand up and walk out on me, I promise I will get back to all that's led up to this point. But this morning, I want to begin at the end. 2 Samuel 18, verse 33. It'll be on screen for you guys over there. And the king, King David, was deeply moved and went up to his chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom. My son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, oh Absalom, my son, my son." 2 Samuel 18:33 is focused on a man, a king, a father that we've all become well acquainted with over the last 17 weeks. And yet, this is not the man we've seen charging into battle, having major military victory after victory. This is not the man we see who is the king of this nation that's just starting to rise up, to become mighty and powerful as God intended it to be. This is not the man we've seen seemingly on top of the world. Verse 33 finds us in a completely different place. This man is now broken. This man is now beaten down, despite the fact that he just won a major war, a major battle. Verse 33 recounts the cries of a man shattered, despite the fact that his place as the king has just been restored. David's despondence here in verse 33 is exemplified through a shell of a man who has lost so much and has fallen so far. Naturally, the question is, well, how did we get here? Respond to that. I was the one that took you guys here. I apologize for that. We're at the end of the story. But no, how did we get here? How did we get to this place? What could possibly have led to this response by our king? These emotions. How is it here that in 2 Samuel 18, we find David crumbling under the weight of loss, crumbling under the weight of emotions of a father realizing potentially for the first time that while he's accomplished a lot in his life, King David will go down as the greatest king in Israelite history. He's going to forever be known as a man after God's own heart. He'll be the king that will lead Israel to virtually its zenith of power. And yet despite all of those accomplishments, being a good father is not one of them. You're going to hear two words this morning. I sound like the introduction to Sesame Street. We've got a word of the day. We've got a number of the day. Now, we only have two words of the day. So there's two words of the day I want you guys to kind of keep in mind as we unpack this particular passage. The first word is despite. I'm going to use that a lot. The second word is decision. There are two fun little words that we're going to have some, hopefully, an interesting time dealing with. But I'll say this up front before we dive into the text. For our main character, for King David, despite his apathy, and there's certainly a lot of it in this story, despite his anger, despite his misguided responses again and again, despite David himself, God is still moving. Despite David's decisions, God still moves his plot forward. And as we'll see, I hope we see, that is a beautiful thing. That is a wonderful thing. That is something we can give praise to God for. So let's open up in prayer as we get into this text. Dear Heavenly Father, as tough as it is for me to say, I'm thankful for these stories. And these stories that we get into are hard and tragic and really rough. But Lord, I believe, and we can see it in the text, Lord, that you continue to move your plot forward. You are there. And even if we can't see you, even if David has no intention of even talking to you, Lord, you are still there moving our story forward for us and not despite us. Lord, we thank you for that as we unpack your word this morning. So as I promised, let's go back to the beginning, 11 years earlier, 5 chapters earlier in the narrative. When you get there to 2 Samuel 13, you're introduced to a character, Amnon. This is David's firstborn son, and we don't know too much about him other than what's told in the narrative here. But what we are told about Amnon is really rather concerning. The narration notes that Amnon asks his father for what seems to be a rather benign and inconsequential request. Amnon's been sick for a while. We don't know what he's claimed his ailment to be, but it seems to have stuck with him. He's bedridden, he's down and out, and his father comes to visit his sick son. Verse 6, and when the king came to him, Amnon said to the king, "Please, let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes for me in my sight that I may eat from her hand." Concerned for his son's well-being, David doesn't think twice about Amnon's request. And why would he? David doesn't know, however, what we know from four verses earlier. Amnon's been lying this entire time about being sick in the traditional sense. Amnon doesn't have the flu, doesn't have a cold, he doesn't have any physical ailment that would cause him to be bedridden. Rather, what we find in verse 2 is the real reason why Amnon's quote-unquote sick. After a time, Amnon, David's son, loved Tamar. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible for Amnon to do anything to her. Now, while we can't blame, and I don't think we should blame David, for providing Amnon with an outlet to act upon this lust that had gained a foothold in his heart, we do see that it's David's decision that offers his son an opportunity to do something that's without excuse, that is absolutely despicable, that should be despised. At her father's direction, Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down. The narrator describes Amnon not wanting to eat, refusing to eat, telling all of his servants to leave the house so that only him and Tamar are left. And then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes that she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come, lie with me, my sister." Tamar, completely innocent, Tamar having no idea that by saying yes to her dad's request to go visit her brother that she would run into this situation, she tries everything to flee. She tries logic, reason, she tries to play off of Amnon's emotions, she tries everything she possibly could to get out of this situation. But all of it was to no avail. Verse 14, "But he would not listen to her. And being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her." The narration notes that what happens next is equally, if not worse, than what happened to Tamar by the hands of Amnon. For Amnon immediately becomes, he despises his sister and kicks her out on the street. "I want to have nothing to do with you." And so here's this woman, embarrassed, broken, raped by her own brother, and she has to walk away in shame, not for anything she did, but because of the shameless acts of her brother. David gets wind of what's happened. His eldest son has committed a heinous act against his daughter, nonetheless. And he's faced with responding. Not just because he's the king, and not just because he needs to keep order in society. This should not be happening in society. But also because he's the father of this family. His son did something heinous against his daughter. He needs to do something. But notice what he does with this information. Verse 21, "When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry." He was angry, but he does nothing despite his anger. In fact, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, as well as the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is the oldest manuscripts we have in Hebrew, add this little caveat at the end of this verse. "But he, King David, would not punish Amnon because he loved him, since he was his firstborn." Twice now, the narrator has used the word love in a very distorted way, and this is intentional by our narrator. Last week, we talked about God's hesed, God's enduring, God's long-standing, everlasting love. Well, the narrator is contrasting that with the love of a brother to his sister and the love of a father who refuses to punish a son that deserves punishment. We know from the narrative that immediately after the violation, Amnon's love for Tamar turns to hate. Amnon's love was never love to begin with. It had always been lust. This lust that had sickened him to a point of utter depravity, to the point where he would ruin the innocence of his sister because of the baseness of his desires. And then the narrator notes David's love. This isn't a love either. This is a love that works to enable. This is a love that desires to selfishly sweep sickness under the rug so as not to embarrass the family, so as not to embarrass David. See, here this man after God's own heart, he doesn't even understand love. He doesn't get it. He's incapable of teaching his son what love truly means. This is how far our hero king has fallen. The story continues, and it does so by introducing us to a third character, David's third son, Absalom. Our author sets Absalom up as a foil to David. So this is a literary device authors often use to contrast two characters to further set up their characteristics. What we see in David or not see in David, we see in Absalom. It's a contrasting technique. So notice a few things. David, a part of our story, never once reaches out to his daughter. He never once goes comforts her. He never once goes to her to try to resolve any issues whatsoever. Whereas the narrative notes, Absalom is quick to open his home to his sister, who has just been violated in the worst way possible. He provides for her. He protects her. He works as hard as he can to renew the sister that has lost everything because of this despicable acts of his brother. David, while he's angry at Amnon, he never speaks to Amnon about this. The narration's quick to note that Absalom still speaks to his brother. He doesn't say good or bad to his brother, but he does keep a dialogue open, whereas David shuts that dialogue off. David is good at that, at ignoring the problems he doesn't want to deal with, as we'll see in the narrative. Lastly, and probably most importantly, David refuses to punish Amnon for something that deserves punishment. We'll see that Absalom creates his brand of punishment, his brand of justice, which turns out to just be revenge. But for the next 2 years, Absalom plots how he will get back at his brother for what he has done to his sister. And in doing so, Absalom approaches David with another of those seemingly benign requests. Verse 23, and after two full years, Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, your servants have sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servants." In essence, Absalom is inviting his father to a family gathering, a sheep shearing convention, because that's what they did back in those days. They had sheep shearing conventions. We go to Comic-Con, they go to sheep shearing conventions. That's what you do. But his father says, "No. I don't have time for this." We don't know exactly why. The narrative, the story doesn't tell us. We can assume that King David had kingly duties to attend to. He had people to manage. He had a kingdom to work on, those kind of things. We don't know exactly why David doesn't go with his son to Ephraim, but he does grant his son a follow-up request. Absalom asks that Amnon go in David's place. What happens next will not only have a reverberating stain on David's legacy in the same way that Amnon's actions have a stain on David's legacy, but it'll again point to David's inability to act as a father really should act. In Ephraim, Absalom's 2 years of plotting and planning have finally come to fruition. Verse 28, Absalom commanded his servants, "Mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom commanded. Knowing the repercussions to his actions, Absalom immediately flees north to Geshur. For those of you guys who know modern-day Israel, Geshur is right to the east of the Sea of Galilee. It's in the Golan Heights. It's up against the Syrian border, the modern-day Syrian border. And he does this in part because he's afraid. He does this a little bit out of self-preservation. He's afraid of dealing with the consequences of killing the firstborn son. There's certainly consequences that come with murdering a man, no matter how justified you think you are in doing that. So he doesn't go back to Jerusalem. He runs to Geshur for that reason. But another reason he runs to Geshur is he knows the temper of his father. He knows that when he goes back to Jerusalem, he's not going to face justice. He's going to face the vengeance of his father. The crime will not fit the punishment because his dad has an enormous temper, not an awesome or positive characteristic of David at all. And that's what Absalom's afraid of. So in part, that's why he flees to Geshur. And for the next 3 years, he'll stay with his grandfather in Geshur, afraid to return to Jerusalem. Chapter 14 picks up the narrative back in Jerusalem. And here we run into Joab, which is David's primary, he's top general. And Joab sees a conflict in David that he wants to resolve. Joab sees that David has anger towards his son Absalom because he killed his firstborn son. But he also knew that the king's heart continued to go out to Absalom as his son. We see in this verse, knowing the conflict between David's wrath for his son and yet the longing for his son to be home, we see that David is a truly tragic figure. And yet the tragicness of David's fate is best understood not by what happens to David. There's no outside influence. The Lord is not spiting David. There's no larger narrative that's leading David, much like the Greek or the Shakespearean tragedies that we read about. No. Everything that comes upon David is because of David. David is bringing this tragedy upon himself. David's decisions, not consulting the Lord, not going to the Lord like he did when he was young, this is why tragedy is at his doorstep. Joab sees this conflict in his king and his leader, and he comes up with a scheme to potentially right the relationship between son and father. In order to pull this off, he employs the talents of a wise woman from a town just south of Jerusalem. She's asked to come, approach the king, and share with him a very simple story. Verse 4, when the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on the face to the ground and paid homage and said, "Save me, O king." And the king said to her, "What is your trouble?" She answered, "Alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead. And your servant had two sons. And they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them. And one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan has risen against your servant. And they say, 'Give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed.' And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." In his compassion, David hears this story and breaks over this story. He can't miss the parallels to his life in this story. He's taken back not only to the loss of his son Amnon, but also to the loss of his son Absalom, who's in exile in Geshur. This story reaches its mark, David's heart. And the king is once again faced with a decision. Does he bring his son back despite his anger? Does he bring his son back despite what it may look like to others? Or does he let his son die in exile? Does he let his son face the consequences to his actions in Geshur? The decision that follows is not true of a majority of David's life, but it's certainly true of David's decision-making right here, right now in the story. David has a way, at this point in the story, to find new opportunities to make unwise decisions. I don't know how he does, but he finds a way to make dumb decisions. As if you could look at this and go, David, you have two options. You either let your son stay in Geshur or you bring him home. There is no third option. Well, guess what? David finds a third option. Somehow, some way. Verse 21, then the king said to Joab, "Behold, now I grant this. Go bring back the young man Absalom." Okay, he's bringing Absalom back. But notice what David does to Absalom. Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, "Let him dwell apart in his own house. He is never to come into my presence." So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. David allows his son to return to Jerusalem. David gives him a home, gives him some provision. But he refuses to speak to his son. David decides against better advice from Joab, from his wife, from his family members, from everyone who's counseling him. David decides that he wants to have nothing to do with his son. And this is a fact not lost on a son now who doesn't live in Gesher hearing about this, but now right next door to a dad who's ignoring him. 2 more years will pass, and not as much as a single word is exchanged between father and son. It gets to the point where Absalom is at his wit's end and has to do something. In the narrative, it's really interesting what Absalom does to get Joab's attention, because he can't talk to his dad. So he goes to the second in line, and he gets Joab's attention and asks him a very reasonable request. Verse 32, Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent word to you, come here that I may send you to the king to ask, why have I come from Gesher? It would have been better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death." Absalom is willing to face the consequences to his actions, even to the point of death, just to have a conversation with his father, just to get resolution to the strain that is between him and his father. He's daily reminded, being in the same house, but yet not being welcomed home. David's decisions to ignore his son, David's decisions to vilify his existence is worse in Absalom's mind than had David left him in Gesher to die. What comes next seems to naturally fall in line with David's actions at this point in the story, or at least in this case, his inaction at this point in the story. Absalom has spent the last 4 years being ignored by his father. He's been a pawn in his king's chess set, being moved about, being pushed over here, being shunned, but never truly dealt with. And while I don't agree, and most of us probably would not agree with what Absalom does next, one can begin to see why he responds the way he does to his dad's actions. And it leads us to our third inconsequential request of the text. Verse 7, "And at the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king," arguably this is the first words that Absalom and King David have spoken to each other over the last 4 years. Absalom's request is this, "Please, let me go and pay vow, which I had vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Gesher in Aram, saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I will offer worship to the Lord." David grants his son's request, but Absalom has no intent of going down to Hebron to pray to God. Rather, what Absalom does is he gains popular support, gathers an army together, and he is working his way back to Jerusalem to take over the throne, to kill his father. Now, Absalom had been posturing for this move to the throne for about a year up to this point. And potentially, he's doing it because he's trying to get his father's attention. "Hey, Dad, you're ignoring me. Let me try something to get my dad's attention so that we can have a conversation." Potentially, though, this is a power play on the part of Absalom. He is now first in line. You know, he was the one that killed the firstborn son. The secondborn son died long before the story began. And Absalom is the rightful heir to the throne. So potentially he's down in Hebron gaining popular support, gathering his army together because he says it's my time for the throne. But potentially Absalom's motivation is because he believes his dad is not capable of being a leader anymore. You see, he's seen his dad fail at administrating justice. His dad has failed at showing compassion. His dad has failed at being a good leader within his family as well as for the kingdom. And so Absalom, right or wrong, in his mind, is completely justified as he heads back towards Jerusalem to pursue his father, to take over his throne. "I'm the right king. I'm the best king for this job." David hears of Absalom's plot, and instead of confronting him, and instead of saying, "I can no longer be a coward about this, I've got to face my son and hopefully in peace resolve this situation," David turns east and runs away from his son, runs away from Jerusalem. There's a map on screen here, and this shows the movements of what everyone's doing here. Absalom went down to Hebron, where he gained popular support, gathered an army together, and now he's back moving towards Jerusalem. David gets word of this, and instead of facing his son like a father should have many years before, he turns east and north through Gilgal, crosses the Jordan, and ultimately the end of the story is going to happen up there in the forest of Ephraim, where he will face off with his son up there. From the text standpoint, verse 13 recounts all of this. And a messenger came to David saying, "The hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom." Then David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, "Arise and let us flee, or else there will be no escape for us from Absalom. Go quickly, lest he overtake us quickly and bring down ruin on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." This point in the story, our narrative changes. And it changes from one of revenge and lust and murder and vindication to now one of spies and battle tactics and battle plots. It's a really fascinating story. But for the sake of time, I'm going to speed it up just a little bit. So as you can tell, I'm covering a lot of ground in these five chapters that I invite you guys to go and read on your own, because it's an incredibly fascinating story, and I'm having to skip over some really good parts to it. But in the meantime, let me introduce you guys to two more characters, and these two characters are important as the story concludes. These two characters have very different agendas as they enter into the conflict. One is named Ahithophel. It's actually pronounced Ahithophel, but I'll save you guys the guttural because I have to say his name a lot. So I will cut that out and just mispronounce his name as Ahithophel for the rest of the morning. And the other is Hushai the Archite. Narrator offers us a number of unique details about both these characters. Ahithophel was formerly the head of David's cabinet. He was a trusted advisor of David. He was a man of wisdom that knew how to get kings into power and knew how to sustain that power for kings. In fact, in verse 23, the narrator notes, "Now in those days, the counsel of Ahithophel gave was one as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed both by David and Absalom." On the contrary side, on the other side, we have Hushai. Hushai was also a confidant of David. He was part of David's cabinet. He was someone that David looked to for guidance, for wisdom. And in hastily leaving Jerusalem, David bumps into Hushai. Hushai says, "Let me go with you. You're my king. I will follow you to the ends of the earth." But David says, "I have a different plan for you. Go back to Jerusalem. Act as a double agent for me. Confront, befriend my son Absalom, and work to frustrate as best you can the advice of Ahithophel. The task is simple, but it's extremely dangerous." And so the narrator brings this whole dramatic conflict to, he just keeps pushing the platform, and I love this. Verse 37, "So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem with all his armies, with all those people that want him to be king. Once in Jerusalem, Absalom plots his next move. And in doing so, he turns to his two trusted advisors to ask them what to do next. Ahithophel has the first cut at it. Verse 1, "Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, 'Let me choose 12,000 men. And while I'll arise and pursue David tonight, right now, I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged. I will throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike him down, only the king, and I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace.'" Absalom hears this counsel, considers it, and then turns to Hushai. "What do you have to say?" Hushai answers Absalom, "This time the counselor of Ahithophel has given is not good. You know your father and his men are mighty men. You know that they are enraged like a bear robbed of his cubs or her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is an expert at war. He will not spend the night with his people. Behold, even now he's hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears of it will say, 'There has been a slaughter amongst the people who follow Absalom.' then even the valiant men whose heart is like the heart of a lion will utterly melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is this, that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, as the sands by the sea for multitude, and that you go into battle in person. So you shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and you shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men that are with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there. If you recall from last week, you will remember how often our narrator reminds us, both the reader and King David, who is responsible for David's victories. The narrator reminds us often of who guides David into battle, who offers David success, who leads the leader, who gives David the charge for his life. Again and again, the narrator tells us it's the Lord that leads David. The Lord is the one that guides David. Only the Lord was the one in whom David could trust. What's been conspicuously absent from our story to this point of hate, this story of hate, the story of tragedy, what has been absent from that is God. Now, that's not to say that God hasn't been there. In fact, despite all of David's decisions, despite all of the tragedy, the loss, the pain, God is still moving his plot forward. What our author's been doing, though, instead, by not saying anything about God, is he has a critique of David's approach to life over these last 11 years. You see, David has not chosen during this time in the life to consult God. He's chosen to intentionally not listen to God's wisdom, to not request of God's direction. David has decided not to ask God what to do next for both his decisions of consequence as well as his decisions of inconsequence. God is still moving, there's no doubt about that. But he's moving despite David in this part of the story, not because of David. Verse 14 reminds us that God is still in this story. God is still moving. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." Absalom's fate was sealed that day. And this portion of the story concludes with Absalom pursuing his father into Ephraim per the counsel of Hushai, only to be resoundingly defeated by David's men. Absalom would wait. The counsel of Hushai was, be patient, wait, gather a bunch of people together, which in essence gave his king time. Time to get settled in, time to work on strategy and all of that. Well, Absalom waits, pursues his father, gets resoundingly defeated. And if you read in the story, in a very bitter irony, it involves his hair, Absalom's hair. I'll let you guys read it. It's interesting. He would die at the hands of Joab because of his illustrious, beautiful hair. And that'll make sense when you guys read the story. But upon hearing the news of Absalom's death, David's words of suffering over the death of his son in verse 33, chapter 18, where we started this morning, just resounds all the more as David realizes that it was his decisions that led to this place of loss. This brings up an interesting thought that I was thinking about as I was preparing for this particular sermon. As I was thinking about it, had David taught his son what love truly meant, maybe the story would have ended differently. Had David comforted his daughter in her broken and desolate state, maybe this would have ended more positively. Had David had the courage to dole out punishment in response to an act that deserved punishment, maybe something would have been different. Had David gone with his son Absalom to spend time with his family, maybe they could have talked. Maybe they could have resolved their issues, their concerns. Had David invited his son back from exile and instead of shunning him, welcomed him, talked to him, worked through their issues, maybe something would have been different. Had he punished Absalom even to the most consequential of extents? Lastly, had David left Jerusalem to lead his men into battle instead of remain in the comfort of Jerusalem, maybe things would have been different. Now, I'm sure a lot of you guys said, wait, that last one? That wasn't in our story. What are you talking about? I was following, I was tracking on all the other ones, but what are you talking about? David staying in Jerusalem instead of leading his men into battle. Where are you going with this? Well, next week, in pure cliffhanger fashion, in order to invite you guys to come back, Troy's going to go back a little bit further in David's timeline to where we picked up our story. And he's going to deal with another one of those inconsequential decisions that would set into motion a generation of consequences that comes to a head in 2 Samuel 18, verse 33. You see, David's pain over the loss of his son is set directly against a series of decisions David makes long before Amnon and Absalom show up on the scene. As we'll see, David is in fact solely responsible for the tragedy that has ripped his family apart. But that's next week. And hopefully I haven't written Troy's sermon for him, so I apologize, Troy, if you're forced to now respond to what I told you guys it was going to be. But until then, I want to end this morning by looking one more time at plot. And the fact that despite our decisions, God still moves his plot forward for us and not at our expense. Tamar will never get her innocence back, but she is not forgotten in this story. Her brother Absalom protects her. Her brother Absalom brings her in, refuses to allow her to become pushed to the fringes of society. And I believe what her brother Absalom does, we as Christians are called to do. For those who are wronged, for those who have had injustice in their life, we're called to redeem as best we can those who are hurt. We also know that Tamar's legacy lives on. This is a beautiful part of the story, but it's just one little verse that gets often missed, but I want to highlight it. Verse 27, there were born to Absalom, Tamar's brother, three sons and one daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. Despite the decisions of others, despite the lust of her brother, God did not forget Tamar. But there's more to this plot. 3 weeks ago, I was in Jerusalem. I was standing on the Mount of Olives, looking back from the same vantage point that David would have looked from as he fled Jerusalem. Now, this is not some shameless way to show you my travel pictures. It's just happened to be a great picture. Obviously, the city that David was looking down is a vastly different city than I saw. But our tour guide brought up an interesting point. We're standing there, and we're reflecting on this as we're standing at the Mount of Olives. And she is noting that, you know, this is the same place that David looked. And instead of turning back to Jerusalem to confront his son, to deal with his son as a father should have, for self-preservation, David decides to flee, to walk away from Jerusalem. What's interesting about this point, though, that our tour guide added, and that it forced me to just think, was this is the exact same point that Christ stands as he walks into his Passion Week. This is the exact same vantage point where Christ has a decision to make. Do I walk away from Jerusalem because this isn't my battle? These aren't my sins. Or do I take a step towards Jerusalem and towards that cross? For the sake of our story, for the sake of our salvation, Christ decides differently than David. David turns and runs. Christ turns and walks towards his death. It's a beautiful picture. We were talking about this last night As people were coming up and commenting on the sermon, saying, wow, this is a really rough passage, this is a really rough sermon. And I could not help but reflect on the fact that I am so thankful that we do not worship David. We worship Christ, the one who took the step towards Jerusalem and not away. I have a little homework for you. I'm that long-term sub that still gives homework rather than, you know, just, oh, you guys are free to go because the teacher's not here mainly. My homework is this. I want you guys to take the application home this week. I encourage you guys to read Mark chapter 14 and Mark chapter 15. There's a lot in it, so you don't have to read it all at one time. I actually recommend that you don't read it all at one time. But maybe take the first half of Mark 14 on Monday, the second half on Tuesday, the first half of Mark 15 on Wednesday, the second half on Thursday. But as you're reading, keep a little notepad to the side, or if you mark up in your Bible, underline, circle, do whatever you need to do. But what I want you guys to do as you're reading Mark 14 and 15 is trace all of the decisions Christ makes as he works towards the cross. You're going to notice there's a number of things Christ says that helps him move towards his ultimate goal, which is death on the cross. There's a number of things Christ does for that end. There's also a number of things Christ doesn't do and doesn't say so that he can get to the cross. There's a lot of opportunities, as you'll see in the narrative, giving you guys a little hint of what you're looking forward to. A lot of opportunities where people say, well, if you're the Son of God, just stop this pain from happening to you. And Christ decides not to do that and instead take on the brunt of our sin on that cross. In addition to tracing all the decisions Christ makes over those two chapters, also maybe in a different color or different notation, however you guys want to do it, also mark all the places of all the people, individuals or groups of people, that try to prevent Christ from reaching his goal. You'll notice there's people inside his group, Judas, Peter, and there's also people outside his group, the Pharisees, Herod, Pilate. And they're all trying to upset what Christ is attempting to do by walking towards that cross. Notice both of those things. Mark those things down. Trace them Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And on Friday, certainly not the Good Friday we celebrate before Easter, but a Good Friday for us, take some time. Now, I recommend 30 minutes. Feel free to do more. Feel free to do less. Whatever you guys want. But take some time to reflect. And in thanksgiving, thank Christ for every single one of those decisions that you've been tracking in that narrative. Thank Christ that he did not say, you know what, this isn't my battle. I'm going to leave. Thank Christ that he overcame every single obstacle that was put in front of him for his ultimate goal of our salvation, his mission to the cross. Despite those around him who were trying to stop him from getting to that cross, Christ still decides to move the plot forward for us and not despite us. Let's close in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for the cross. And I thank you from that vantage point looking over an incredibly complex, an incredibly troubled city as Jerusalem is, Lord, that you walk towards it and not away from it. That unlike David, the hero that we have come to love and adore that has fallen so far from you, Lord, unlike David who has fled from his fatherly duties, flees from his kingly duties, unlike that, David, Lord, you said, no, I'm walking towards the cross. I'm walking towards Jerusalem. Thank you for that, Lord. Thank you for your cross. And I pray that this week we can reflect on that. And we pray all these things in your beautiful, precious, wonderful name, Christ. Amen. If you guys all want to stand with me, we'll have people up front, friends, if you want to share in prayers, if there's anything on your heart. For the rest of us, may we go this week. May we go this week with decisions that are both godly and, I don't pray ungodly decisions, but decisions that are ungodly, knowing that God still moves his plot forward. May we rely and trust on God with everything that is on our plate. And may we be thankful and reflect on all that Christ has done, regardless of what we do, that is for us and not against us. Go in peace this week, guys. Thank you. Blessings.